but if it means three hots and a cot, I'm all in. Things were pretty lean this winter at home. I didn't know what I expected the space elevator to be, but it wasn't what I expected. It looked most like a waiting lounge at an airport. The huge disc-shaped elevator car had four levels, with the lowest level containing the machinery, or so I supposed, since we were only allowed on the upper three levels. Cargo pods were slung below the bottom of the car. The habitable levels were each divided into eight wedges, containing row after row of thinly padded plastic chairs. Chairs with seat belts. The trip up to the orbital station was scheduled to take 9 hours, hours enlivened only by crowding around the viewports and looking down at our receding planet's surface. After a while, even that got old. The elevator was a no-frills contraption, designed to transport a maximum number of troops in a minimum amount of time. Comfort on the trip was not a Questang priority. There wasn't even a snack bar built into the elevator. So the army had set up a portable kitchen on each level, and the food was plentiful. I had my first decent cheeseburger in a very long time, then went back for another. Jesse and I explored the place, wandering around, meeting the soldiers we'd be serving with, swapping stories, listening to contradictory rumors. Since the elevator had a capacity of 5,000 humans, a good part of a full army division was aboard on our trip. We wandered by one wedge that had been set up as an impromptu officer's mess, poking our heads in, before moving along to mix with the rest of the grunts. After I'd downed three sodas, alcoholic beverages not being supplied by the army, I needed to check out the bathrooms, which I had been dreading. What kind of plumbing had the Questang provided? Either the Questang had similar biological functions, or they had consulted human plumbers, because I need not have worried. It looked like a typical highway rest stop bathroom, only new and cleaner. The dispensers even had soap. The trip at first was slow. It really was like riding an elevator. There was a subtle pressure of extra gravity and a faint vibration. As we climbed and the atmosphere thinned out, we accelerated, and the artificial gravity kicked on to compensate at what we were told was about 85% of Earth normal. I talked to one of the army cooks who had been up and down on the elevator several times. As we approached the space station, he explained we would slow down, but we wouldn't feel any movement because of the artificial gravity. I expressed doubts about the safety of riding a lightning bolt, especially with Ruha raiders still harassing the Questang. The cook told me not to worry. Earlier in the week, a Ruha frigate had popped out of hyperspace while the elevator car was halfway to the space station at its most vulnerable point. The frigate had fired off two missiles before it got popped by a pair of Questang patrol destroyers, and defensive lasers on top of the elevator car took care of the incoming missiles. It was nice to know we weren't entirely sitting ducks while we ate snacks and sat in uncomfortable chairs. I managed to fall asleep, slumped over in a chair. I woke up when a Marine kicked my foot.
"Rise and shine, Sleeping Beauty. This joyride is coming to an end. Collect your gear if you have any."
The Marine moved away, kicking awake other sleepers. Jesse had been asleep on the floor behind me, using his duffel bag as a pillow. I shook his shoulder.
"Oh, man, your ugly face isn't what I want to wake up to," he said grumpily.
"What's up?"
he managed to say through a jaw-stretching yawn.
"I think we're approaching the space station. Want to get a look-see?"
The station was a donut with six arms radiating out. At the end of two arms were what I assumed were Questang ships, resting what looked like belly down on platforms. One of the ships was sleek and dark, the other much larger and not as powerful-looking. While Jesse and I gawked, the cook I'd been talking to earlier came over and squeezed through the crowd to stand next to us.
"That," he pointed to the smaller ship, "is a cruiser. And the fat ugly one next to it is the transport ship."
"You been on it?" Jesse asked.
"Nah, they only let us on the station while the elevator car is unloading. Then it's right back down to Ecuador for the next group. I hear the transport ship can hold this whole group. As soon as you're aboard, they're leaving."
"Any idea where they're sending us?"
I figured the cook might have heard something on one of his trips. He shook his head.
"I don't know. And if any of our officers know, they ain't saying. Personally, I think the Questang are keeping it on a need-to-know basis, and we humans don't need to know."
We watched silently as the elevator car slowly approached the station until the bulk of the station cast a shadow across the window and hid the cruiser from view.
I wish I was going with you. Tried to switch to infantry. His uniform patch said he was first armored. But the army said my MOS is cook. So that's what I'm doing.
He sounded bitter.
Hey, you make a damn fine cheeseburger.
I stuck out my hand.
He wiped his hand on his apron, gripped my hand fiercely, and looked me straight in the eye.
You guys are going to kick ass, right?
Damn straight, I answered with conviction.
I didn't know if I was coming back, but I was going to kill as many hamsters as I could. Every soldier and Marine I talked to felt the same way, the same deadly sense of purpose. We'd been attacked, the very survival of our species threatened. Rage wasn't an adequate word to describe how we all felt. In the train station in Boston, I'd been walking through with three other soldiers headed for outer space and war, and the crowd noticed us. People stopped, spontaneously started saluting. Then they applauded. It really touched me. I remember one old guy, must have been a grandfather, had his young grandson with him. He showed the little guy how to stand and positioned the boy's hand to salute us. The expression on the grandfather's face right then told me everything about how people felt about us soldiers in the United Nations Expeditionary Force. We were carrying all their hopes, and not only hopes for vengeance, hope for survival. Survival of the human species. That's what made this war different. For the first time, we really were all in this together.
Damn straight, man. We're going to kick ass, Jesse said with all seriousness, and we bumped fists. Army strong, can't go wrong. Hoo-ah!
Like the cook, we didn't get to see much after we left the elevator car. U.S. Marine guards directed us into the space station, which generated the lightning bolt we'd ridden up into space. We lined up in single file to do what, I didn't know. The station was big. I wondered aloud how they'd built it so fast.
Atheranin Star Carrier brought it here in sections, and they assembled it. A lieutenant in line ahead of us said.
Sir, I asked. What is a Theranin?
The Theranin are the patron species of the Krestang.
Reacting to the totally blank stares he got from me, Cornpone, and everyone else, he stepped slightly out of line to speak to us. From his uniform patch, I could see he was with the 3rd Infantry.
Didn't they tell you people anything?
Sir, I'm from northern Maine. We first got the Internet a week before the Ruhar attacked. I could see he didn't appreciate my attempted humor.
I've never heard of the Theranin, sir.
He twirled his finger in the air.
This station? The elevator? That's all Theranin technology. The Krestang don't even have artificial gravity aboard their ships.
Sir? Jesse's face began turning green when he heard that. Everyone in the line was looking queasy at the idea of experiencing no gravity.
Zero G? We haven't been trained for that. At all.
That's why you're in line here, to get meds to prevent space sickness. We can't have humans puking their guts out in a Krestang transport ship.
We're not going on a Theranin ship? I asked, feeling queasy already.
I was deeply regretting that second cheeseburger. The line moved forward, and we shuffled our feet along the deck.
Theranin star carriers rarely venture down into a gravity well. They stay well out in the Oort cloud of any star system.
Seeing more blank looks, although I was feeling smug that I knew what an Oort cloud was, he added,
That means out beyond the orbit of Pluto, where space-time is flat and it's easier for their star carriers to form a jump field. Krestang ships can only jump short ranges, we guess 6 to 8 light hours, which is about here to Neptune. They make a series of small, faster-than-light jumps like that out to where a Theranin star carrier is parked. A star carrier is a big, long spine with hard points for short-range ships to latch on. The star carrier has an advanced jump drive, way beyond what the Krestang have, so the Theranin carry Krestang ships between star systems. G2 thinks the Krestang ships can't actually travel between stars. With their short jumps and the need to recharge engines between jumps, overall they travel at less than the speed of light. It would take them more than 4 years to get to the nearest star from here. The Theranin, we think, can travel something like 300 times the speed of light, in jumps of about 1 light-year.
I didn't like the math that was running around in my feverish brain. 300 times the speed of light was incredibly fast, but it also meant that if we were going to a planet that was, say, a mere 100 light years away, it would take 4 months to get there. 4 freaking months. Stuck on an alien ship and zero gravity. And 100 light years sounded like a lot, but the galaxy is huge. Somewhere in school I'd learned the Earth is 27,000 light years from the center of the galaxy, and the whole galaxy is something like 100,000 light years across. I hadn't considered any of this when I was so eager to get off Earth and fight the Ruhar. "Sir," I asked slowly, "where are we going?" "That's not a secret. We're going to a planet the Kristang have set up as a training base for us. We're calling it Camp Alpha." "And how far is that?" Cornpone asked as he shot me a look. He was doing math in his head also. "The Kristang won't tell us, but people who've been there took pictures of the night sky, and from the position of stars, our astronomers have got it fixed at 1,223 light-years from Earth." Just then one of the doors at the end of the line opened, and the lieutenant was called in. Oh my God. A 1,200 light-year journey aboard a ship that traveled 300 times the speed of light meant we were going to be stuck aboard a Kristang ship attached to a Theranan star carrier and zero gravity for 4 years. I'd heard the troubles astronauts had aboard the International Space Station in zero gravity, how their eyesight deteriorated, their bones became brittle, and their muscles wasted away after a couple months. What good were human soldiers going to be after 4 years in zero gravity? I was so shocked it didn't even occur to me the lieutenant had said somehow humans had already gone to Camp Alpha and come back, obviously in much less than a year.
4 years? Dang! Is that right? 1,200 light-years away at 300 a year?
Cornpone's voice reflected the shock we all felt.
Maybe they're going to freeze us, make us sleep the whole way. They did that in Avatar, right? You saw that movie.
People were grumbling, stunned at the implications of what the lieutenant had told us. Then it was my turn with the doctor, who was wearing civilian clothes and a white lab coat. She looked bored. "Do I need to take my shirt off, ma'am?" I was hoping I could keep my pants on. It was embarrassing enough standing around in my boxer shorts in front of a male doctor. With a female doctor, it was worse. I mean, I didn't want my friend to be obviously happy to see her, if you know what I mean. But maybe it was worse if he didn't rise to the occasion. The doctor was cute, and I was a healthy guy, so I felt that out of respect for her, I should at least have a semi...
"No, soldier, keep your shirt on. Lift your chin, please."
She held what looked like a plastic and chrome gun under my left ear and squeezed the trigger. I hardly felt anything. Same thing on the right. She put the gun down and checked a computer display screen, tapped it a few times, and said,
"Looks good. You've been injected with Kristang nanomachines that will soon migrate to your inner ears and prevent you from feeling nauseous in zero gravity. They will dissolve after a while, and you shouldn't feel any effects. If you do feel like your balance is off while you're in gravity, contact the medical staff aboard the ship."
"Ma'am, how long will we be aboard?"
"You will receive a full briefing aboard the ship."
The door opposite where I'd come in opened, and I took a hint to leave. The gravity was working fine. It was the thought of being injected with tiny machines that was making me queasy. Microscopic alien robots were swimming in my blood. It was creepy. Once our group was all done with the doctors, guards directed us to the transport ship and hustled us along with no time for sightseeing. There wasn't much to see on the station corridors anyway, blank walls in a light blue color with markings in several human languages attached to the walls. The Kristang ship was more interesting. Lots of access panels, corridors going in every direction, pipes or conduits along the ceilings. The walls and floors had recessed handholds, I guess for when the ship was in zero gravity. No Kristang were visible. I still had never seen one of the lizards in person. A Marine took charge of our group and directed the men into one compartment, women into another. The compartment I was in had row after row of bunk beds, stacked three high. Each group of three bunks was attached to an arm that could rotate the stack 90 degrees for when the ship was under thrust. The Marine told us this was a Kristang multi-mission pod, which was currently configured for troop transport. We were lucky, he said, that the bunks were sized for Krestang, who were slightly larger on average than humans. I shrugged and found an empty bunk, tossed my small duffel bag into it, and secured it with a strap that I figured was there for that purpose. The bunk wasn't bad, 7 feet long and about 4 feet to the bunk above it. It was almost luxury. Somebody already had a card game going. Jesse wandered over to the game while I flopped on my bunk and pulled out a book to read on my tablet. I was getting anxious about the tablet. It was down to about 25% power, and there didn't appear to be any electrical outlet anywhere. It looked like I'd been stupid to bring the thing into space with me. A sergeant came to stand in the doorway. He cleared his throat to get our attention. I was amused to see he was wearing the same out-of-date style uniform camo top that I had on.
I am Staff Sergeant Rayner. I'm in charge of this compartment and the two on either side of you. In 2 hours, this ship will undock and boost out of Earth orbit. You all need to be in your bunks and strapped in 10 minutes before departure. If you don't know how to work the straps, Specialist Edwards here will show you. After we depart from the station, the artificial gravity will cut off, so make sure you don't leave anything loose that can float around. This ship will boost for about an hour. The acceleration is only 30% of normal gravity. It's not like NASA rockets. Then the ship will make a jump through hyperspace. You will be able to get out of your bunks once the Krestang give the all clear, in about 90 minutes. After that, you're free to move around. Keep in mind we'll be in zero gravity. I don't want any jackasses horsing around in zero G. Once the ship gets far enough away from Earth, we will be making a series of hyperspace jumps, and you will need to be in your bunks for those also. Our ultimate destination is a planet the Krestang have set up as a training base. If you have any questions, you will get an opportunity to get answers later.
If I was going to be stuck in my bunk for over an hour, I decided to hit the bathroom first. I went back out the door and asked the Marine guard where the bathrooms were. He pointed down the hall with a wry smile. The restroom facilities were interesting. There were no urinals. You could sit normally, but the toilets were designed for zero G, and there were straps to hold you in place, and the seat formed a seal on your backside. And there was a flexible tube with disposable cups if a guy only had to pee. The stalls all had instructions plaques in several human languages, and it was not as complicated as it sounds. The toilet's computer took care of everything. Score a point for technology. Krestang also apparently had unisex bathrooms, so we took turns. 5 women, then 5 men. Damn, women take forever. There were a lot less women than men, so it wasn't a big deal. On my way back to my assigned compartment, there was an army captain standing in the hallway reading something on a tablet. I saluted and stopped to talk to him if I could.
Excuse me, sir, how do you charge your tablet?
In each compartment is a set of magnetic pads. Set your tablet on it and it'll charge. It's like a charging mat, and it senses what kind of juice your tablet needs so it won't burn it out. Theranan devices are smart.
What's a Theranan, sir?
The captain shook his head.
The Theranan are a very advanced race. They lead the coalition that the Krestang belong to. I'm told they look a bit like aliens in sci-fi movies, short and skinny with big bald heads.
Now I was completely confused.
The Krestang aren't in charge?
As far as we humans are concerned, yeah. Anything to do with Earth, the Krestang are in charge. The Theranan are the Krestang's patrons, is maybe the right word. Anyway, all you need to know is traveling from one star to another is a slow process in a Krestang ship, so they latch on to Theranan motherships for the big jumps. And before anyone asks, no, I've never actually seen a Theranan. We stay aboard the Krestang ships.
This is getting complicated, sir.
He nodded sympathetically.
Think of it this way. The Theranan are the major leagues. The Krestang are, the AAA farm team. And we? Well, we're kind of the semi-pro local league right now. We're hoping to get promoted to single-A ball, but we need to prove ourselves first, and we got a hell of a long way to go. Get back to your bunk, soldier. We're boosting out of orbit soon. You'll get a briefing later.
After an hour of gentle acceleration boosting away from Earth, and 10 minutes of what I guessed was preparation for the jump, our transport ship jumped. I couldn't see anything strapped into my bunk. When the ship jumped, it felt like static electricity crawling on my skin for a split second,
Then it was back to floating in zero-G. I kept track of time on my watch. It took 8 hours, 21 minutes between the first and second jumps. Later, I learned that Kristang ships are powered by fusion reactors, and their jump engines take about 8 hours to build up enough power for a jump. That time lag between jumps can be a major tactical liability for an attacking force. The attacking ships, which have just jumped into combat, mostly can't jump away immediately if they get into trouble, whereas a defending ship, with fully charged engines, can pop to a different location if it has a swarm of missiles incoming. In actual battle, the time lag between jumps is not so much of an issue. Warships always maintain reserve energy for a short emergency jump. Ships can't safely jump in or out of hyperspace near a large gravity field, such as a planet. The jump field can get distorted and tear the ship apart. So an attacking force needs to come out of hyperspace away from a planet and travel through normal space to get into orbit. Once the attacking ships get close enough to a planet to use weapons, they are so far within the gravity field that even ships with fully charged engines can't safely jump. Defending ships, which never know where an attacker is going to pop out of hyperspace, tend to hang close to planets and then move out to intercept. If that sounds too much like a game with lots of rules to memorize, it is. Lucky for us humans, we don't have to think about it. We don't have any starships, and the Kristang aren't giving us any. We're infantry. We fight on the ground. The Kristang get us there, and we'll take care of the fighting. That's what we all thought then, anyway. Between jumps, the ship boosted for about 2 hours. Then we had free time, when we could be out of our bunks. Everyone experimented with moving around in zero-G. I could see after only a few minutes that we should have been issued helmets. Sergeant Rayner came in to yell at us for stupidity, but mostly let us get bumps and bruises. Experience is the best teacher. One of the show-offs was Jeff Murdoch. He came into our platoon in Nigeria halfway through my tour there, so I didn't know him that well, but, man, he took to zero-G like a dolphin takes to water. He was doing flips that would have made me dizzy, and he could push off a wall and float across the compartment to wherever he wanted to go, swimming through the air. He hung from a bunk upside down, using his feet to hold himself in place with a huge grin. "Man, this is great. I can't wait to get some of that Kristang biotech. I'll be a super soldier, man." The rest of us weren't so enthused about watching him fly around like a giant squirrel. "Murdoch, you don't need advanced alien technology to be a soldier. You need a freaking miracle," Garcia laughed. "Yeah, man, what you need is a brain. And you better talk to the Wizard of Oz about that," was Thompson's comment. "Hey, fuck you guys," Murdoch shot back, and flew across the compartment, spun, and landed gracefully on the opposite wall. He didn't even bounce. "You'll see." We were brought to the Kristang version of a chow hall or dining facility. Or maybe it's called a galley since it's on a ship. Our experience with zero-G in our bunk compartment helped when we had to pull ourselves along corridors through the ship. The chow hall held almost 100 people and had tables and chairs. What made it different is those chairs were solidly attached to the floor and had seatbelts. Lunch was MREs. Humans couldn't eat Kristang food, and the Kristang didn't want us screwing with their kitchens in zero gravity. MREs reminded me of camping when I was a kid. And they weren't bad, but I'd eaten too many of them in Nigeria, and I glumly ate my food, swapping stuff with the people around me. Cornpone was extra hungry. He gulped down his MRE and bummed a pack of crackers off me. Halfway through the meal break, an army major came floating into the compartment, expertly flew across to the opposite wall and hooked his feet to a strap. He made it look easy. "Is everyone enjoying their astronaut food?" That drew a laugh from the crowd. "I understand there's a lot of bad intel going around, so I'm going to set you straight. First, we will not be in zero-G the whole way. This Kristang ship will latch into a Theranan star carrier for the majority of the journey. The hard points on the star carrier are platforms that have artificial gravity, so after we're attached, we'll have the 85% G that is normal for the Theranan. Second, this journey will not take 4 years, and you will not be frozen. So you'll have to listen to your bunkmate snore." Another chuckle from the crowd. "The Theranan star carrier will be jumping to an artificial wormhole and then passing through the wormhole to the other side, which is hundreds of light years away.
The Star Carrier travels between wormholes and lets the wormholes take us most of the way to our destination. It's going to be 17 days from Earth to our first destination, a planet we're calling Camp Alpha. That's a training base where you'll receive your new weapons and equipment and learn the rules of engagement. The Krestang are sticklers about us adhering to the ROE, so pay attention while you're there. We are not going to cause problems for our new allies. As for Camp Alpha, I have been there. And all I will say about it now is that it is an excellent place to focus on our training mission.
That drew a knowing groan from the crowd. We all understood that was army speak for a hellhole where there was nothing to do but work and train. I looked at Cornpone and we shrugged. We'd seen worse, and we weren't out in space for a pleasure cruise. The Major didn't take any questions and left the chow hall when he was done with his brief speech. I felt a lot better knowing we wouldn't be stuck aboard the ship in zero-G for 4 years. After the Krestang ship made a fourth jump, we had to stay strapped into our bunks as the ship maneuvered to latch onto a Theranan mothership. There was a clanging sound and a vibration as our ship attached itself to the Star Carrier. Gravity slowly came back to cheers from everyone I could hear. Especially when it was announced that we'd have hot food for dinner now that the kitchens had gravity. It was beef stew, with a lot more potatoes and veggies than beef, but it was a promise that we wouldn't be surviving solely on MREs for the next 3 weeks. And the biscuits were hot and fresh. Good chow is important for good morale. The Army sure knew that. I like fresh hot biscuits, in case you were wondering. The Theranan Star Carrier, mothership, whatever you call it, then went through a series of jumps I lost track of because some of them happened while I was asleep. Some people aboard the ship were trying to keep amateur records of all the ship's maneuvers. Jumps, time between jumps, time and force of acceleration. Personally, I lost track after the second jump, and I figured we had qualified people keeping track for us. The loudspeakers woke us up around 0300 one night when the ship was approaching the wormhole, and I wished I had more warning, because my bladder already was sending me warning signals. The idea of falling into a wormhole, having my atoms ripped apart and reassembled, or whatever it was that happened, had me scared. I was laying rigid in my bunk, waiting for the unknown, when the loudspeaker announced, "Wormhole transition complete. Secure for normal space maneuvering." Damn. Not only did I not need to have worried about the wormhole passage, I didn't even realize when it happened. There were more jumps, more waiting between jumps, and lots of boredom. We exercised in shifts, using equipment brought from Earth, including treadmills and exercise bicycles. I liked running, but I hated treadmills. It was so boring. Even competing with the guy on the treadmill next to me didn't help after the first couple days. We played games on our tablets, and exercised, and read books, and watched movies. Being aboard the ship was kind of what it must have been like for soldiers in World War II, crossing the Atlantic and Pacific in slow transport ships. Except on a World War II transport ship, those guys had been able to go up on deck, get fresh air, and see the sun and the horizon. We had decent chow and enough room to move around on the ship, except for the areas off limits to humans. What we didn't have was anything to look out the window at, if there had been windows. And we didn't have any news from or contact with Earth. In Nigeria, I'd been able to get onto the internet and send emails and video chat with my folks and friends, at least most days. Here, we were out of contact until we came back, a long, long way. One thing we'd learned is that not even the technologically superior Theranan had faster-than-light communications, except for drones which carried messages by jumping. Kind of like a high-tech carrier pigeon. After a while, I felt we were low-budget tourists stuck aboard a crappy cruise ship. It didn't feel like being in the Army. After a bunch more hyperspace jumping that I didn't even bother trying to keep track of, the Star Carrier arrived outside some star system, or so we were told. The Krestang ship went to zero-G again, detached, and jumped 4 times. Finally, we maneuvered into orbit at our destination. All in all, my first interstellar voyage consisted mostly of being stuck in a windowless compartment. I wouldn't recommend it for a vacation, unless you're desperate. We did get a good look at the planet below, and it wasn't inviting. Earth from orbit looks blue and green and tan, where there are deserts and grasslands and white ice at the poles. This place looked brown and red, and even the places that had water weren't a nice blue. The one pole I could see had an anemic layer of dirty white like snow beside the road in April when it's all dirty and crusty, and everyone wishes it would just freaking melt and go away, damn it. In groups, we packed into the mess hall to get a briefing. Lieutenant Gonzalez stood on a chair and waited until everyone got settled into the compartment.
Welcome to Camp Alpha. The Kristang didn't want to tell us their name for this planet, so it was just Alpha.
Some guy at the front asked,
But we know where we are, right, LT? I mean, somebody has figured it out?
Yeah, Gonzalez smiled. The advance team took pictures of the night sky, and astronomers on Earth calculated where the view must have been taken from.
I think the Kristang were having fun with us, keeping it a secret. They must have known we'd be smart enough to discover this planet's location.
We're still in the Orion arm of the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, about 1,223 light-years from Earth. That's far enough that you can't see our sun from here without a telescope. I'm told our sun is an unremarkable star anyway. Has everyone been to the window and seen where we'll be training? Camp Alpha is not the kind of place you would go on vacation. It is the kind of place where soldiers are trained and formed into an army the Ruhar will learn to fear. The Kristang have set aside this planet as a training and staging base for humans for three reasons. First, nobody else wants this place. It's dry, and I'm told that it can be 110 degrees in daytime and down to 20 below at night. And that's the nice part of the planet where the training base is located. The sunlight is a funky blue-white color, and it will peel the skin off your bones if you aren't protected. Second, because this place is so damned nasty, it's a nice place to train. Not every planet we'll be going to is like Earth. Here, you will learn to use the equipment the Kristang provide, and to survive in harsh conditions. If you can't be combat effective here, we don't need you. And third, the Kristang chose this place because they think the Ruhar don't know about it. Yet.
Sir, someone asked, why is the planet all brown and burnt-looking?
The star here is a slow variable. It hiccups every once in a while and increases its output. When that happens, it scorches the entire system. Then it settles down again.
Hiccup? That sounded like one hell of a hiccup. The crowd of us shifted uncomfortably on our feet, and a low murmur went around.
Don't worry about it. The Kristang know the star schedule. It won't flare up again for another 10,000 to 50,000 years, Gonzalez added hurriedly. A range of 10,000 to 50,000 years sounded like the Kristang should have just told us they had no freaking idea when the star would next blow up.
Your briefing packets have all the info you need about this planet, so I'm only going to cover the high points. There is life down there. The biggest animal is an insect about 3 inches long. It has sharp pincers, and it's venomous. But the venom isn't fatal to human biochemistry. It only causes a mild rash, sometimes, as an allergic reaction. Most people don't react to it at all. The only things that are dangerous to us down there are the climate, which can get really hot and really cold, and our own stupidity. Use common sense. Remember you're here for training, and read the regs. They're written to keep you alive and combat ready. We will assemble into units when we get dirt side. Until then, follow instructions.
Chapter 3. Camp Alpha.
There was no space elevator at Camp Alpha, so we made the trip to the surface on a Kristang shuttle. Only I learned it wasn't called a shuttle, or a drop ship, or a lander, which were other terms I'd heard people use. The Army term was surface-to-orbit craft, or stock. In practice, we called such ships either drop ships or stalkers, like stock car, only one word. Stalkers would reach orbit by themselves, not needing booster rockets, and some of the larger types were capable for interplanetary flight if you had plenty of time on your hands and got along really, really well with the other people you were squeezed in with. The Kristang and other species did have craft they called something like drop ship. But dropships were used for large-scale invasions, to ferry lots of troops and equipment down to the surface, a one-way trip. Technically, a dropship was like a World War II glider. They could survive entry into an atmosphere, maneuver a bit before landing, and land vertically. But once down, they stayed there. Dropships were one-shot craft, whereas a stalker could climb back into orbit and make the trip multiple times. The distinction didn't matter much to me, as I would only ever be a passenger. But it was cool knowing how our senior partners did things. It made me feel part of the team, not just a cog in a machine. The dropship I squeezed into held 220 people and our gear. It was the size of a 747, roughly, most of it being engines and fuel tanks. The ride down was rough. We hit the atmosphere, and it felt like I had a sack of concrete in my chest. Then it got worse. Man, I was glad when the ship leveled out and flew like an airplane for a short time. We all cheered when that happened. The actual landing was uneventful. I realized we were down only when the engine sound cut off. Me, landing on an alien planet. Who would have thunk it, huh? Lieutenant, someone asked, do you know who was the first human to set foot on another planet?
Probably General Mears,
a soldier behind me said. Mears commanded UNEF. Nope. Gonzalez shook his head. It was a female British Army captain, part of the multinational advance team. It was supposed to be a Chinese Army colonel to go first, but this British captain was seated next to the door, and when they landed, the Kristang pilot told them to get out, pronto. The Kristang didn't see humanity's first landing on another planet as a big deal. They wanted them all off the ship quick so we could get back up and pick up the next group. Damn, I've been hoping the first person was an American. Well, we still had Neil Armstrong, and old Neil had done it with good American technology. This Brit only hitched a ride on an alien space bus. My own first footstep on another planet was almost embarrassing. I was used to the 85% gravity of the Theranan Star Carrier and then 0G again, and Camp Alpha's gravity was 107% of Earth normal. The unfamiliar weight caused me to stumble down the ramp. And Lieutenant Gonzalez hadn't been joking about the heat. When we got off the dropship, I was hit by a furnace-like blast of heat. And humid, too. None of that bullshit about it feeling cooler because it's a dry heat. And bright. I had to shade my eyes and squint to make it the 100 meters to where the transport vehicles were parked. Everything smelled burnt, like the aftermath of a fire. The oxygen content of the atmosphere was supposed to be only a bit lower than Earth normal. It sure felt like my lungs were sucking air and not getting a whole lot of benefit. Maybe the landing site was at a high altitude. I'd almost reached the transport truck and was waiting in line to board when a woman behind me swayed and began to slump to the dusty ground. My own head was swimming from the sudden heat like a head rush when you stand up too suddenly at the beach. She protested and tried to push me away, but it was clear her knees were wobbling. Listen, I checked the name above her left pocket. Hey, Miller, we are Army Strong. I repeated a U.S. Army recruiting slogan. We don't let each other down, not in combat, and sure not in this stinking heat. You got that? She nodded angrily and leaned on me, breathing heavily, until she could stand up again. I could tell that needing assistance, even briefly, was killing her pride. Thanks, she glanced at my name tag. Bishop. God damn, it's hot here. I'm from Seattle. Ha! Northern Maine here. You don't know what cold is. She let me hold on to her shoulders to steady her a few seconds, until her legs stopped shaking. 10 feet away, a guy's knees buckled suddenly and he face-planted in the dirt, another victim of the sudden heat. Miller recovered and climbed stiffly into the back of the truck by herself. Once the truck was loaded, we drove off to a tent city that was being built atop a bluff. I looked around, trying to savor my first moments on an alien world. And there wasn't much to savor. It was dry and dusty, and the air still smelled burnt, so the smell wasn't from the dropship's engine exhaust. Low vegetation clustered around rocks. It appeared to be a type of pulpy, fleshy lichen. I guess the plant stored its own water supply, like a cactus. Bouncing around in the back of the truck, we looked at each other and grimaced knowingly. Camp Alpha was our first alien planet, and it sucked. Sitting on the truck was my only time to savor the experience. As soon as we got to our assigned campsite, the Army put us to work setting up tents. The heat wasn't so bad, now that I'd had time to get used to it, but the extra gravity was a bitch, and the burnt smell had saturated my nose. A staff sergeant assigned me, Cornpone, and 5 others to set up a large medical structure made of prefab insulated wall panels. It was tougher than it looked. Let's start with this sidewall section, I said, hoping that the sooner the tent was complete, the sooner we could go for chow. There was a muffled sound, like a really long, high-pitched fart. Then the moaning started.
Is that bagpipes?
WTF, Cornpone exclaimed. Yeah, there's a British battalion on the other side of the camp. I jerked my thumb over my shoulder to where I'd seen the Brits building their encampment.
And they play bagpipes? For real? I thought that was an Irish thing.
Garibaldi scoffed. Scottish, not Irish, you bonehead. Damn, don't you know nothing? Valdez said, hey, you hear the one about the Scottish guy? He's sitting at a bar, drowning his sorrows in whiskey.
Everybody got a good grip on it? I asked.
Lift with your legs, not your back.
Cornpone snorted. Damn, Bish, you sound like my mother. We got this.
So he says to the bartender, Valdez grunted with the effort. He says, so you build 30 houses, and when you walk down the street, do people say, there goes McDougal, the home builder? No, they don't.
We got the wall up on top of our knees, and I told the team to get under it and lift it to our shoulders. The extra gravity was killing me.
Then he says, you save 5 children from a burning building, and when you walk down the street, do people say, there goes McDougal, the rescuer? No, they don't.
Valdez, will you shut up a minute?
All right, people. Lift, I said in my best U.S. Army voice of authority. We got that bitch of a wall unit up above our shoulders and were winning the fight against gravity when Valdez gasped,
then McDougal says, but you fuck one sheep.
We lost it. Men scattered as the wall unit came crashing down, and people were rolling on the ground laughing. I tried to bark in order, but I was laughing so hard that a snot bubble came out of my nose, and when people saw that, they fell over laughing again. Lieutenant Gonzalez shot a dirty look at us, and a sergeant started walking in our direction. It was official. I had no business being in charge of anything. The Army had made a huge mistake, giving me even responsibility to set up a tent. I got the men back together, and we tried to lift the wall unit again, but every time we got it a few inches off the ground, Valdez started laughing at his own joke, and it cracked everyone up. Finally, I sent Valdez away to get us some water, called over a half dozen more guys, and we got the damn thing set up right and fixed into place.
One sheep, Cornpone laughed, and I couldn't help joining him.
After we got the tent set up, Cornpone and I finally connected with the other two guys of our old fire team, Sergeant Greg Koch and Private Dave Chaika. We called Koch Sergeant. Now, he had a nickname, but you needed at least Sergeant stripes to use it. Unless you wanted a 6'3" shaved head black man from Georgia glaring at you. Yeah, you didn't. Dave we called Ski, because he was from Polish stock around Milwaukee, and even though his last name didn't end in Ski, the rest of us figured it should have. Really, it was his fault for not having a decent nickname when he joined our unit. Damn, it was good to get the band back together. I trusted all three of them with my life. We'd gotten into some hairy shit in Nigeria. We'd come through with nothing worse than some scars and bad memories. Before I left home, I'd sort of kept in touch with them by spotty emails, but I hadn't heard from them since then, and Cornpone and I weren't sure either of them had made the trip from Earth. They had. They'd been on a different Krestang ship and arrived at Camp Alpha a few hours before us. Koch got us bunked into a tent, which we had to help set up, and he figured out where to go for chow. We were happy campers. Sergeant Koch went off to do important sergeant things, and the dining facility wasn't opening for dinner until another 3 hours, so Cornpone dug into his pack for snacks. What you got? Ski asked. Cornpone winked. Let's see. Damn! I got a genuine smorgasbord of hoo-ah bars.
A smorgasbord? I asked skeptically.
Really?
Oh, yeah. A smorgasbord, at least. Could be a plethora. Maybe even... ooh. An honest-to-God, gosh-darn cornucopia of snack foods.
It was funny to hear Jesse say plethora in his deep southern accent.
Cut the bullshit, man. You're making me hungry, Ski protested. What flavors you got in there?
Well, I got cinnamon cardboard, of course. Also raisins and gravel. And my personal fave, original sawdust.
Crap. I got stuck with raisins and gravel. The raisins were harder to chew than the gravel.
The next morning, we were marched out to the shooting range after chow time.
It was cold. The thermometer outside our tent said it was near freezing. Excitement was high. We all expected to finally get our hands on some incredible, super high-tech weapons from the Kristang, and maybe clothing that automatically heated and cooled you. I felt naked without a rifle. Standing in front of us was a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant with a crew cut so severe it looked like it could cut your hand if you touched it. He wore combat pants and boots, but over his top was a red U.S. Marine Corps sweatshirt.
"I am Gunnery Sergeant Cragen of the United States Marine Corps."
Cragen paused as shouts of hoorah and Semper Fi rang out from the crowd.
"I am relieved to hear that we have a few qualified riflemen among us. Since the rest of you are Army, I'll try to talk slowly so you can understand."
The other Marines laughed at that remark.
"Listen up, people."
There was a gray box on a table in front of him. He touched a button on the side of the box, and it swung open silently. Everyone craned their necks. We were finally going to see the super high-tech weapons that we'd be killing hamsters with. So it was understandable to hear the grousing when Sergeant Cragen pulled what looked like a standard M4 rifle from the box.
"Oh, screw this. You've got to be kidding me.
It's bullshit, man."
"An M-goddamn-4.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot."
Which meant, of course, what the fuck.
"Man, this is for shit," Ski whispered to me in Cornpone.
Cornpone just spit on the burnt, dusty ground. Those were some of the milder comments. Cragen let the protest die down rather than chewing us out for lack of discipline.
"People, say hello to what we humans are calling the M4B1. The Kristang don't trust us with anything more powerful, and we won't need it for the missions we'll be assigned for the immediate future. The M4 Bravo unit fires ammo similar to the 5.56 Mike caliber 223 long cartridge you used to. The difference is this."
He picked up a bullet from the table and pointed to the tip.
"This is an explosive charge. The Kristang assure us this ammo will penetrate the body armor that Ruhar soldiers wear if you select the explosive option, because the explosive is a shape charge, like a heat round our tanks use. You can also select to deactivate the explosives, which you will do, depending on the rules of engagement in effect at the time. The way you select the mode for the explosive tip is with this switch here."
He pointed to a recessed button on the back of the grip, which was convenient for right- and left-handed soldiers.
"You slide up this cover in the grip to expose this recessed button. It is recessed so you knuckleheads don't activate the explosive tip option by accident. After firing 9 rounds, which you can do in standard single shots or 3-round bursts, you have to press the button again to select explosives."
Cragen went on at length about the M4 Bravo, but for most people the thrill was gone. Where was the self-guided ammo, the lasers, the genetic enhancements to make us super soldiers, the bionic eyes, the mech suits that allowed us to jump 30 feet in the air and run 100 miles per hour? Where was all the cool stuff we'd seen in sci-fi movies? This was bullshit. The Ruhar could pound us from orbit with masers, railguns, and smart missiles, and all we had were Vietnam-era rifles with fancy firecracker bullets? Total bullshit! A couple hours later, I got an M4 Bravo in my hands on the firing range. It felt exactly like my trusty old M4, which I'd left behind at Fort Drum when I'd gone home on leave. And I never went back to Drum, so my rifle might still be there. The Kristang supplied us with conversion kits for our regular M4s and the ammo with explosive tips. We learned later that much of our ammo came straight from Earth with no fancy enhancements because the Kristang had a limited supply of the explosive stuff. Each squad would get Kristang clips equal to half the normal weapons load. The rest would be regular 5.56mm ammo. Our allies figured we wouldn't need fancy ammo for the missions they were assigning to us. It was a bit insulting. Any tough jobs in this war would be done by the adults. Us human soldiers were sitting at the children's table. My M4B1 came with 2 clips of explosive-tipped ammo. I took my turn on the firing range, practicing using the button to select explosives or not. The explosive mode was impressive. There was much cheering along the firing line as we saw metal targets shredded. Our regular bullets bounced off the targets, leaving only little shiny dents.
One advantage of Krestang ammo is that every cartridge was exactly the same, down to the nano level. Even better than what our snipers called matched ammunition. And Krestang ammo fired much cooler and cleaner, so you could rock and roll without melting or fouling the barrel. We still needed to take our weapon apart and put it back together, blindfold it, and clean it. I took one of the Krestang bullets out of a clip and examined it closely. Other than being a different color and being perfectly smooth with absolutely no scuff marks or scratches, it looked like the standard NATO ammo I'd been using for years. We were going into battle with none of the hoped-for enhancements, having to hitch a ride to every planet, and we weren't entrusted with any important missions. It was like the Krestang were merely humoring our desire to get into the fight. This was the future. It wasn't what I expected. That first afternoon while we were on the firing range, a group of aircraft flew by, low and close enough for us to see them clearly. The aircraft circled around for hours, practicing landings, takeoffs, and formation flying. I say aircraft instead of spacecraft because the instructors on the firing range told us that's what they were, designed to fly in an atmosphere and not capable of reaching orbit. What surprised me is they were Ruha aircraft, not Krestang. Wherever we were going next, the Krestang wanted our pilots ready to use equipment captured from the hamsters instead of the Krestang having to transport their own equipment across the star lanes. There were two basic types, known by the names given by humans. The Buzzard, which was a transport ship like a V-22 Osprey tilt rotor, and a sort of two-person gunship like an Apache that we called a Chicken. Just like the way we called the Ruha hamsters, we gave disrespectful names to their aircraft. They were both vertical takeoff and landing craft like helicopters or tilt rotors, but they had jet engine pods at the end of their short wings, not rotor blades. We all had to admit they looked cool. And we were all proud to know humans were flying them, and would be flying them in combat. Soon, we hoped. The next day, we got some of the other minimally upgraded toys the Krestang were allowing us to have. The most useful toy was a personal tactical radio that hopped frequencies, transmitted in encrypted bursts, and used wide-field white noise jamming in the background so their location was very tough to pinpoint. We all got a personal radio the size of a typical Earth smartphone, except it was thin as a credit card with a touchscreen that couldn't be scratched, and you couldn't damage it unless you shot it with an explosive-tipped round. With the radio came an earpiece and microphone to wear under our helmets. Our helmet cameras transmitted video through the new radios, so squad, platoon, and company leaders could see what their soldiers were seeing. We could also take the radios off our belts and use the screen to select cameras in our squad to view anyone else's camera. And instead of one person in a unit being the designated radio operator and lugging a heavy piece of equipment around, every soldier now had the ability to communicate to anyone else across the planet. The touchscreen popped up a menu written in whatever human language you spoke into it. English, Spanish, French, Mandarin, Hindi, you name it. The radio understood it all. We all had to admit that was cool stuff. People who had a military occupational specialty related to comm equipment were out of a job, since humans were not allowed to screw with the gear and didn't understand it anyway. Personally, it was all magic to me. The Army wanted us to call the new tactical radios Tackers, for tactical radios. Some jokers were calling it the Z-Phone, because Z was as far beyond I in the alphabet as the Z-Phone was beyond the iPhone. I'm sure the Army had some official name like Radio Tactical Multipurpose Krestang Supplied in accordance with Mil Standard blah blah blah, whatever. The coolest feature of the Tackers was they could be used as translators, which was great, because none of us spoke a single word of Ruha. I spoke some broken Spanish, and had learned some useful phrases in Hausa and Yoruba when I was in Nigeria, but really I wasn't even all that good at speaking American. Your and your still got me confused, which drove my mother bananas when I sent her email with grammatical errors. We all got to practice with our Tackers in translator mode. What you did was put the earpiece in one ear and speak slowly and clearly into the little boom microphone near your mouth. You had to speak a couple pages of your native language when you first used your Tacker so the translator could understand your particular speech pattern. Somehow the thing was able to figure the difference between my Down East accent and Cornpone's southern drawl. That was impressive by itself. You spoke into the mic, paused, and your words came out of the Tacker's speaker in whatever language you selected. It could even detect another language being spoken near you and automatically translate that into your own language. The sound on either end was smoother than I expected, although it still was clearly a computer voice. What impressed me was that the Tacker handled slang pretty well, even ubiquitous military slang. When it didn't understand something, it made a humming sound, the machine equivalent of, There was a French battalion a couple kilometers away at Alpha. A couple of their squads came over to visit one day, and the Frenchies got bombarded with requests to talk so we could both try out our Tackers in translate mode. It was great. They spoke their Frenchie babble into their mics, and I heard it in English. I learned for one thing that French toast is not called French toast in France. It's called pain perdu. Which makes sense when you think about it. I mean, why wouldn't the French just call it toast? Although, why did we call our cheese American cheese? Why didn't we just say cheese, right? Maybe I'm getting off the subject. Anyway, it was weird to hear me speak and the Tacker repeat my words in French, especially since the Tacker actually used a French accent. It was so funny for both sides that we had great fun saying stupid stuff and hearing the Tacker translate it. Probably that was not the training the Army intended, but we did get a lot of use out of the translator and got comfortable with using it. Some people reported they had tried the translator with Chinese and Indian troops on visits to their parts of the base, and it worked darn well. As for how it worked with the Ruhar, we practiced with a computer speaking Ruhar. And all I can say is I sure hope the damn thing worked as well in the field as it did in practice. Another new toy drew more groans when it was shown to us. Gunny Cragen again was standing on a platform in front of us. This time he pulled a bulky tube out of a box.
Say hello to the FGM-148 Bravo Javelin missile.
Shit. The Javelin was a decent enough weapon. A man-portable fire-and-forget anti-tank missile that I'd used in Nigeria. But it had some issues. For starters, the description of man-portable was pushing the practical limit. The damn thing weighed 50 pounds. Civilians may think a weapon that enables a single soldier to destroy a main battle tank is worth every one of its 50 pounds, but they haven't humped one through the bush day after day. And that's 50 pounds on top of your rifle, 180 rounds of ammo, radio gear, canteen, MREs, and anything else the Army thinks you need to carry. So javelins are assigned to two-man teams, at least. In battle, one man acts as a spotter while the other operates the weapon. Then they both get the hell out of there as fast as they can. Shoot and scoot, we call it. Anyway, Cragen was speaking.
You all know the strengths and weaknesses of the Javelin missile. Our allies have helped us with the main weakness, the infrared targeting system. The manual says the infrared seeker cools down in a couple seconds, but we all know that depends on the conditions you're in. When it's 98 degrees in the desert or jungle, it takes longer to go active. The Kristang have given us kits to upgrade the seeker on the FGM-148 Bravo. It now cools fully down in less than half a second, and it stays cool for up to half an hour, so you don't have to worry about using it right away. After half an hour, you have to turn it off, but 10 minutes later, you can activate it again. Be aware that every time you do use it, it won't stay cool as long. That's all in the manual. The seeker's imaging system is also upgraded, so if you've ever had trouble on a hot day getting the weapon to recognize a target that is almost as hot as its surroundings, that is no longer a problem. Also, once you identify a target to the weapon, it will stay locked, even if you or the target move.
There was a scattering of slow, ironic clapping. Cragen gave us a sour look.
I know you people expected laser rifles and nukes the size of a hand grenade when you came out to the stars. We don't have that. This is what we have.
He hefted the Javelin Bravo over his head.
And we're going to fight to the very best of our ability.
What he didn't say is our ability to fight would be greater if we had better weapons. Whatever. The Army says we fight with the force we have, not the force we'd like to have. Hoo-ah. After a mildly depressing and disillusioning week of training for space warfare, with essentially the same weapons I'd used in Nigeria, we finally got a truly high-tech new toy to play with.
The Javelin Bravo anti-tank missile, like our original Javelin, had a minimal anti-air capability, limited to use against low-flying helicopters. The Krestang must have decided that none of our manpad missiles